All right, and we should be live. Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, here with a special report. You'll notice I don't have my normal studio behind me. I'm actually on vacation this week. My youngest daughter is a senior in high school, and this is her last spring break living at home with us. And so we thought we'd go out in style and do a last hurrah in Hawaii. So that's where we are right now. So I'm literally just got off the beach, came back, took a quick shower so that I could join my good friend Axel Merck here and discuss his reaction to the latest Fed announcement and the press conference with Fed Chair Jerome Powell that just concluded a few hours ago. Axel, how are you?
Miserable to see you in paradise and being stuck in sunny California. That life is just so miserable on my side of the things. Now,
I'm so sorry, my friend.
Yes. Now when I can listen to Powell, I'm in a good mood. I am doing all right. I am doing all right. And no, I did not fall asleep during Powell's speech. And before we talk about what he said, I do like to remind people why we listen to Mr. Powell. It's not that he is so exciting. It's because he controls the bazooka. Everything in quotes is priced off the reference that he sets of the Fed funds rate. They have the big bazooka, the big stick, and so you may or may not like what the Fed does, but it matters what the Fed does. And that's why we listen to it, and that's why we muse about it, because they don't have a formula with which they do things. It's based on their mood, and so we try to assess their mood.
All right, and that's a very important thing to note just for those that maybe this is their first time tuning into one of these, Axel, is you have long beat that drum, which is that the frame more or less is operating without a framework. The Fed is operating without a framework. You would love to see them have some sort of logic by which they make their decisions. But don't let me put words in your mouth here, but it seems here to you that they just sort of take it much more of, we'll kind of know it when we see it. And as a result, everyone's kept guessing, perhaps even the Fed themselves.
They have a very qualitative, not so much of a quantitative approach. They definitely look at lots of data. The reason, just to take a step back, the reason why that's a problem, you saw that in the inflation burst that we had. When you have a committee decide on raising rates, it's human nature to try not to do that, to see the glasses half full. And of course, there are some quote unquote hawks on the Fed, but when you have a group discussion, you're going to be reluctant to say that we take the punch bowl away, the party is over, you're coming out of a pandemic, lots of government spending, and so people are late. And the problem is, of course, it causes enormous damage, enormous inflation. The Great Depression was caused by a Federal Reserve that made the qualitative decision that they did at the time. And so it doesn't need to be that way. The 1970s inflation was induced by the Federal Reserve. The Fed is not equipped to deal well with a supply shock like we had in the 70s or we had recently. And so one has to go back to the drawing board. And very, very unfortunately, the Federal Reserve hasn't done that. All they said is, well, everybody else had a tough time too, so we might as well continue what we're doing.
All right. So I got a lot of questions here for you, but let's just summarize sort of what the Fed said. So they basically said, look, we're not making any changes, right? So we're keeping interest rates where they are for now. Powell keeps saying they're going to be data dependent and they're going to, you know, do whatever we need to do. So we'll stay flat, we'll cut, we'll hike. It's all going to depend on what the data tells us to do. But he is continuing right now to, you know, if I had to kind of sum up his speech, it was, hey folks, I got this. Like we're good. Like, you know, things are going according to plan. We're going to get inflation under control. It might be a little bit of a bumpy ride, might go up some months, might go down some months, but it's we're going to get below our 2% target. We're going to keep unemployment real low, and like, I got it. Don't worry, anybody. So What? So he's still guiding, the Fed is still guiding the market, you know, with its famous dot plot to three cuts this year. So I think they're saying they expect the Fed funds rate to be at about 4.6% at the end of this year. The dot plot did move up a little bit in 2025 and 2026, which, you know, some folks are looking at as a little bit of, you know, of a hawkish development that what, regardless what Powell is saying, the FOMC members are seeing inflation being a little bit more persistent than maybe, you know, they thought earlier. But Powell has been very dismissive about inflation worries, basically saying again, like, folks, I got it. We're going to get there. It may take a little while, but we're going to get there. What else did you hear?
Well, the big question is, what were you doing at the beach? How did you come up with all this summary by sitting at the beach? I think you're spot on just about everything that you said there. And when, by the way, when we say that the Fed doesn't have a system or whatever, is, well, one gets used to, of course, reading the tea leaves of what they say. They see the same things we do. And as you point out, right, we are chugging along. We got this, right? And the context here is, and part of the reason why the markets were quite excited about it is because people thought, oh, maybe this uptick in inflation that we've seen is going to have them change their mind. And what I pointed out, that the January numbers that came out in February, they're every year they're a mess. It's and partially just because of how these data are collected. The unemployment report, for example, in January, you have seasonal layoffs. And the further you get into January, the more layoffs you have. But depending on how the calendar falls, the sampling that the Federal Reserve does is earlier or later in the month. And then that distorts the number and we suddenly get better employment than expected. And so economists tend to shrug off these numbers. And then on top of that, of course, the Federal Reserve wants to see several months of something. It's one of the reasons why they're late in reacting, but similarly, they're late in changing. They believe they've done the wrong thing. They're in their own echo chamber. So they think they have done what's needed to tame inflation. So their internal bias is we're not going to do something. And so the only thing that Powell did is he actually articulated that. He articulated that we think we're in a good spot. And unless inflation is going to be much worse, we'll chunk along. And then what the market really focused on is what you point out is these dot plots. A few years ago, they were shrugged off entirely. Now these dot plots suddenly have become a communications tool. And sure enough, because of that uncertainty, they haven't changed much. Now, just to throw something out there, that doesn't mean they won't change in the coming weeks or months. They will be, as they like to say, data dependent. And inflation coming in worse, that means we'll have fewer cuts. Remember a few months ago, we actually thought, the market thought there would be something like 6 rate cuts. Now they're 3. The one thing that has changed is the June rate cut was almost priced out and now it's priced in again. For me as an investor, why does it all matter? Maybe we should ask that as well. And it does matter ultimately that the Federal Reserve is in an easing cycle, even if so far it's only in words. But we see that in various markets that they're in an easing cycle. They don't actually need to ease as long as the market thinks they're going to ease. And even if that target gets pushed out and out, that does have a stimulative effect in the markets.
Right. Well, they love to jawbone, right? So if they can move the ball closer to where they want it to be just by talking, obviously they'll always do that when they can. A couple of things. One, financial conditions have eased so much now, especially given that the markets, you know, have just been on this tear and really for the past year plus, you know, no matter what the Fed said, the market's gone higher. But financial conditions are now just as loose as they were when the Fed started its rate hike regime back in late 2021. So, you know, from a financial condition standpoint, it's like the Fed hadn't done anything in the past.
Well, they've taken away the tail risk, right? Or at least until the next black swan hits us. A year ago, when they came to the rescue of small banks, they already were in a situation where a lot of people were fixed had long fixed term mortgages, and And so the housing, normally high interest rates affects the housing market the most. Well, it did in the commercial real estate side of things, but that wasn't allowed to happen. And so they've patched that up. Those problems aren't gone, but they haven't created any systemic risk. And then at the same time, you have a government give a huge stimulus with the amazing deficit spending that we have. And so the one thing that's left is the consumer. And indeed, I'm still in the half empty camp on the on economic growth, because if you look at delinquencies, they have been rising. But at this stage, right, various economic numbers are holding up. And so the Fed is chunking along. And I think it's because of the consumer data that aren't great, the Fed is on an easing cycle, because otherwise, if it was just that financial conditions were easy, as you point out, people would argue, hey, just keep rates where they are. Obviously, the economy can handle it. And there is a very good argument for that to be there. But Powell indicated, no, we don't need to be convinced at this stage that inflation is going to go down dramatically. And on top of that, we don't think we need a recession before we ease rates. And so the market is happy and says, okay, we'll get three rate cuts.
Yeah. And so, you know, also too, you know, Powell was asked specifically about the recent inflation readings, you know, early this year that came in higher than normal. And he really did his best to say, they're not really that bad. You know, it's like January, we were a little bit nervous, but to your point, January is always a little wonky. It's like February, yeah, it was higher, but it really wasn't that much higher. So, you know, definitely giving the markets the sense of like, you know, from an inflation standpoint, things shouldn't be that bad, which of course makes people think, okay, you know, then he's going to be able to cut sooner, right? Great. But he also, to your point about the Fed going through an easing cycle, you know, we can argue that the Fed has been in an easing cycle with things like draining the reverse repo program and the elements of the BFTP or BTFP to rescue the banks. And so those have been providing sort of stealth liquidity into the marketplace. And then today he was pretty adamant, or not adamant, but he was pretty, I don't want to say insistent, but he kept mentioning the fact that, hey, we're going to start slowing down QT. Right? Like QT's, you know, it's been going on in the background, it's doing its job. But you know, today or this week, you know, we all talked on the FOMC about the need in the coming pretty near term that we're going to start, we're not going to end it yet, but we're going to start slowing its rate. And part of that was, you know, he was asked about the reverse repo program. And he basically said what I think a lot of analysts have been writing, which is, you know, once that program is drained, that's when you're really going to start to feel the bite of QT in full. And so it looks like the Fed is planning to diminish the bite of QT right around the time that thing begins to end. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But you know, to a certain extent, we've been thinking about the Fed as being in this tightening cycle, but there have been these other things, you know, in parallel that's been running that has actually kept things, I think, net on a net basis, net liquidity positive. And it's not just been all the Fed, there's been all the deficit spending and stuff like that going on in parallel. There was stuff with the TGA that Janet Yellen was doing, which I think is why we haven't felt the bite of the hiking campaign and the QT as much as most folks expected when it started.
The first thing I like to say is that if anybody lost you in this complex explanation, they shouldn't blame you. They shouldn't blame the Fed. The Fed has made this overly complicated. And you're absolutely right, right? Powell was talking about, oh, the QT, we're going to slow it down, and therefore we can go further. We'll fine-tune this. The Federal Reserve used to manage the federal funds rate by intervening in the markets with purchase and sales of treasuries. They have completely abandoned that and moved to this paying interest on reserves and then the excess reserves regime. And now they're draining these excess reserves. It's a completely complicated setup that I don't think is necessary, creates a lot of confusion. And notably, the Federal Reserve doesn't understand it either. They don't understand where the breaking points are. And the reason they don't understand where the breaking points are is because the regulatory environment is so complex that and including contradictory regulations at times, that it isn't easy to know when they hit thresholds. And Powell pointed out that liquidity isn't evenly distributed. Well, that's a very nice code of saying that they have no idea where the skeletons are and where the breakpoints are. And so, but yes, we do know that if they hit one of these breakpoints, they can take out the fire hose and fix it. To me, that's not how you build a solid foundation. And so when you say QT has been doing its job, I don't think it ever did its job. I think it's out there. They needed to reduce the balance sheet. They've done that, and that's good. But again, they should go back to basics, because you don't need that complexity. And to something you said in the beginning, I think you just reiterated the confirmation bias, right? I have my own bias, how I think economy may go, what policy may be appropriate. And Powell has his bias. And so he thinks, oh, we don't need to worry about inflation too much. They were petrified about the repeat of the 1970s. But last October, I'd call it a mission accomplished speech, where he kind of said, yep, I think we did it. And ever since then, he's been trying to look for an excuse to ease. He hasn't had an opportunity to execute on that, because inflation numbers have been a little worse than expected, but not terrible. And so he continues to wait until he can ease. He has his confirmation bias. And so I accuse the Fed of not being quantitative, but that doesn't mean you can't read of what they're up to.
Yeah, okay. So, well, you know, the Q&A I always find so enlightening, is trying to get a picture of how Jerome Powell thinks. And he seems to me, certainly compared to a guy like Greenspan, you know, pretty transparent in terms of just sort of explaining, you know, what's in his mind. Either that, or he's a master actor and is just, you know, putting up a front and thinking something totally differently. But I do get worried at times, sometimes, when he makes a statement, and I'm like, really? So, he talks about how the Fed's mandate is price stability and maximum employment, right? And he was asked about the job market. And so first off, he talked about how the Fed, it's projecting the unemployment rate, which is currently at 3.9, to be at 4.0 by the end of this year. And I think like only 4.1% by the end of next year, right? And, he said, look, I read these things that people say there are cracks in the employment market that are beginning to show, but he's like, I don't see them. He then cited, you know, some of the data out there, like the low hiring rate. And he said, yeah, I'm hearing people say that, but we don't see it in the data. And he said, and I look at initial claims and those are super low, so we don't really have any worries. And I mean, Axel, nobody believes those initial claims numbers. I mean, the numbers that are coming out of the BLS these days just seem so incredibly broken at this point. And I've actually talked recently on this channel with an analyst who actually works pretty closely with the BLS. And her thesis, after having talked to them, is that they're doing their best, but COVID, with the tens of millions of firings and then scrambling to hire everybody back right after that, it totally broke the BLS's models and the bullwhip effect. They've been trying to catch up, but the bullwhip effect is still reverberating, and it's just not making their models that good until things really equilibrate. And so if Powell is really looking at things like initial jobless claims and saying everything looks just hunky-dory, I think you and I could probably come up with a pretty long list of things that at least give us some pause about the current health of the jobs market. What's the danger here that the Fed is really looking at faulty instrumentation and taking the wrong assumptions away from them?
Well, let me comment on a bunch of things you said here. First of all, when the Federal Reserve says unemployment will be at 4.0, 4.1%, the one thing we do know is it is almost certain that unemployment will not be at 4.0, 4.1%, simply because historically the record is so bad. It doesn't mean it's going to be higher or longer, but we kind of know that's likely to be wrong. But you mentioned the maestro in the beginning, Greenspan, and so let me maybe draw some parallels here. You say that that Powell is more transparent. Don't confuse transparency with an attempt of market manipulation in the sense that you're giving forward guidance. It used to be, and actually Greenspan introduced forward guidance somewhat, and it's gotten more, but he did it on a very subtle level. And then down to people these days saying, yeah, we're gonna be lower for 2 years or 3 years. This forward guidance business is really, really bad. And the reason why it is so bad is because it takes away information from the yield curve. Rather than allowing the market to give the Federal Reserve a reflection of the state of the economy, they're looking into their own mirror. And that addresses the question you're asking in the end. What about if the instrument that the Fed is looking at, the data, they're not good? Well, the one place that is good is the market. And that is why it is so imperative for the Federal Reserve to get out of the market. And they should also get out of the business of giving forward guidance, because then you can get the yield curve and other financial data, credit spreads, for example, give you information. But when the Federal Reserve is firefighter and gives a lifeline to banks, you don't get feedback from the market. The same thing, right? Rather than paying interest on reserves, if the New York desk were to intervene in the markets to manage the federal funds rate, they see weaknesses in the banking system on a daily basis. They don't see that anymore. So they have taken valuable tools away, and instead they're stuck with things that, as you point out, right, the folks at the BLS and other offices, they work hard. They try to do the right thing, but they're hostage of their own models. And they cannot possibly be of a very high quality. Now, the Federal Reserve will tell you, hey, we have a whole bunch of these indicators, and taken together, they give us information. Sure they do, but they're all giving you information with substantial hindsight. Whereas if you had market-based indicators, you'd have real-time indicators. It would be much, much better.
Okay. Folks, by the way, I should have mentioned this at the beginning of the recording here, or this live session here, which is that we're doing this live so that you folks who are watching will have a chance to ask Q&A. We're going to get to the live Q&A in just a couple of minutes. So if you have questions, ask them in the live chat. I'll start pulling them out. So I've got a bunch of questions for you, Axel, but I'm going to limit mine so that we can get to the audience Q&A. I find it hard to watch these press conferences, and
you're in Hawaii. Of course, it's hard to watch them.
I know, but today's one like particularly hit me, where Powell is saying essentially, folks, I got this. We're bringing inflation under control. Don't worry. You know, we're going to get it back down to the 2% target, right? And let's say he's successful at that, right? So we had the past several years where we had the most gargantuan monetary and fiscal intervention in the markets in history, right? And what's the net result going to be? The net result is that the bottom 90%, you know, is worse off because their cost of living has just exploded. And yeah, if the Fed gets inflation down to 2%, prices hopefully start growing as much, but that massive price increase we've had to absorb over the past 3+ years, that's not going anywhere. It's not like prices are coming down, right? So the poor and really everybody but the rich, right, is their prospects are permanently diminished based off of that. Whereas the rich, the wealthy, they're doing great. You know, their assets, the asset inflation that's happened, the asset appreciation that's happened has been tremendous, right? Even today, you know, right after the Fed press conference there, you know, pretty much every asset, stocks, bonds, gold, Bitcoin, everything leaped higher, right? That didn't help the average guy who's just trying to make it through the day and put food on the table, but it sure helped the people who have financial assets today. So Powell does try to, you know, give some lip service to, hey, we understand that inflation hurts families and stuff like that. But basically all he's saying is, yeah, we're going to try to put the fire out. You know, not much we can do about your house that burned down, but you know, whatever, we'll try to put the fire out at least. Right. I mean, I just, it there's no sort of sense of like, you know, we were kind of complicit and we overreacted and, you know, yeah, maybe we didn't really know what was going on at the time with COVID. So history won't maybe, you know, judge us too harshly, but sorry, everybody, we just made life 20%+ more expensive for you than it was a couple of years ago.
Well, inflation is the most cruel of taxes because it does hurt the middle and the lower class the most. And I mean, you phrased it very well. And that's why I say it is absolutely inexcusable that the Federal Reserve gave us the Great Depression, Great Inflation One, Great Inflation Two. And the reaction is, well, let's double down on what we're doing. They still have their, I call it asinine, that's a technical term, backward-looking inflation averaging on the books as their goal. And then in a few months, they'll start their next review of how they may go going forward. The reason why I pound this table on they have to be more quantitative is because the qualitative approach simply has not worked. This obsession first that we get inflation down to the second decimal and then to somehow suggest that inflation less than 2% is bad. Inflation, Paul Volcker had this right? Inflation that is negative is only bad if it's associated with an implosion in the economy. But if it disinflation happens because of technological advancement, it's to be celebrated. And so in the meantime, of course, the Federal Reserve is hostage of the environment they're in. And clearly both parties these days have figured out that spending gives you more votes. And so they are stuck in this environment. This lip service then to say, hey, meanwhile, if we think about the poor, I don't know, that to me, they have a bazooka that is not a fine-tuning thing. And so they'd rather, to me, they'd rather worry about getting inflation down than to try to say, hey, we do this one way or the other. It's just, you're playing people for fools because most people don't understand the Fed. They don't see how their purchasing power gets eroded. And the flip side of that is, of course, that people get upset. And so then people get upset, and that does have implications that goes way beyond their savings, because then they'll start voting for more populist politicians. People get disillusioned with what they think is capitalism when the sort of interventions we've had are all but capitalism. And they will vote for more socialist or populist ideas on the left or on the right. And so there is real damage that's done with these sort of policies. And it's one of the things, reasons why I like your program, because you help educate people, because people need to know what's happening so that they can prepare and maybe vote for people that put some sense into the world.
Well, thank you for that. That is actually, it was sort of a cornerstone of the mission of why we created Thoughtful Money. But let's get to some of the damage that this does to sentiment and, you know, in many cases, providing incentive, maybe malincentive for behavior, because people are saying, look, the Fed is doing one thing. I need to run in the direction the Fed is telling me to run in. And then sometimes that can have really bad results. So this is a tough question, but it's a fair question. So it's from Jack D. He says, how can anyone remain bearish at this point? How can you guys even speak with a straight face after today? And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily incredibly personal attack to you and I, Axel, but it's, I think, to anybody who's sort of been waving the flag of caution, right, over the past year or so, where understandably, if somebody's just looking at the tape, they're saying, what are you guys saying? The stock's just always... Let me just combine this with another one here from this fellow, BDEC. He says, I'm more bearish now than I was 2 years ago. Problems haven't been fixed. They are worse. So this is the vice that the thinking investor has to be in, right? Which is, we see a lot of these concerns. I see the potential for big corrections, maybe even a real break in the system at some point because of all this. But at the same time, the music's playing, stocks are going up. I got to make money to retire on. Should I just be long this game? Should I just learn to love the bubble and you know, not worry, right?
So I want to give you two answers, but now I'll give you three. After reading that, how can you be bearish? I said, okay, great. I now I have to be bearish, right? If the bears get ostracized. Now the second one, oh my God, I'm even more bearish. Well, if everybody's bearish, I got to be bullish, to be contrarian. The way I look at managing money is not where can I make the biggest buck in the short term. To me, it is about risk management. And it's in that context, I also like to encourage your audience to look at anybody who you have as a guest or even what you say. It's we don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what will happen tomorrow. What I can do is I can help people get out of their comfort zone to think about the environment in a different way from which they usually look at it. And then they can make an assessment. Well, does this make sense? Is that a risk they agree to? And if so, am I taking that into account in my portfolio or do I not care? And so then it ultimately comes back to the personal situation, right? The one investment advisor I'm censored in my speech because I'm regulated, but the one advice I can give is to invest in yourself, right? Every individual is a fixed income generating machine with the salary that, and the wages you can, the earnings power that you have. And so if you invest in your skills and then ultimately in your health, the return on that is one of the best returns on investments you can make. And if you have that one squared away, well, what risk can you take that beyond that? And the one thing I like to tell people is that if you can't sleep at night with the risk that you have, then you're overexposed to the market. And I'm as some of your audience knows, that we manage over $1 billion in gold and gold mining. So I'm not talking about the physical gold bar under your pillow, but the comfort, whether you can have that. And so let me give the example of in early 2009, in March 2009, we reached the bottom of the market. And some investors, some brokers said, this is the time to buy, you got to double down. I thought that was completely irresponsible. Now, you may say, well, what the heck? This was the right time to buy. The way to think about it is that most people had not taken chips off the table in the run-up to 2008. And that means they were overexposed to risk assets as part of the allocation. And then on top of that, they lost half of their net worth in the decline in 2008. And then to tell people you've got to double up on your risk is irresponsible. The responsible thing to do is to be preemptive and take chips off the table when times are good, when you can afford to do it. And so it ultimately comes down to, right, what is your goal in life? Is your goal in life to beat the S&P 500? Or is your goal in life to have enough money in retirement so that you don't outlive your savings or something else, right? And so it's, I happen to have substantial amounts in gold and gold mining. I'm not saying that's the right thing for other people or for others. I can afford it. I know that space. I like that space. Most importantly, I can afford the risks that come with that space. And yes, I don't like what's happening in the equity markets. But ultimately, to maybe summarize all that, the most important thing is for anybody to have a plan. It doesn't even need to be a very good plan. But having no plan is usually what gets people to lose money.
You're making me think of an analogy here. Maybe it's a bad one, but if your goal is to enter the casino wealthier than you walked in, right, then you want to do a lot of what you're talking about, right? Take your chips off the table when you're ahead. Get to the point. Hopefully, you're playing with house money. But place prudent, smart bets, whatever, right? That's what people should think of. Most people should think about if they're, trying to build a retirement nest egg. If your goal is to win the poker game, right, to be the last man standing at the poker game, well, you got to take pretty big risks. And most people who have that goal aren't the winner, right? They get killed along the way. So there's only one winner of the poker game, right? And so, if you find yourself taking the kind of risks that the guy who would be trying to win the poker game is taking, you're probably playing the wrong game. That's what I'm saying, right? So if you see your you know, neighbor making a ton of money off Nvidia stock or whatever, and you're like, oh my God, I got to get in right now because my friend is making a ton of money. Like, you're using the wrong playbook for what you're trying to do, right? And to your point, you got to have a plan. Ask yourself what you're trying to do and build a plan that fits your goal.
Yeah, I cringe a little bit here because I don't consider life to be a casino or poker game. I did read Annie Duke's book. She's a former poker champion. Her book is called Quitting or something like that, and talks about how you can win by quitting. That's similarly by quitting your job, or in this case, not taking excessive risks, right? I look at life similarly as I'm a family father of four, right? Three of them are out of college by now, and so one of them is still heading into college. So I guess the responsibility of having to feed them through there is diminishing with time. And so at some point I can focus mostly on the future of my wife and myself mostly, but I have never looked at that as winning in the casino. To me, it's about enjoying the journey. And enjoying the journey doesn't mean having fun every day, but enjoying the challenges of every day. And that includes managing finances, family finances. And so in any of that, right, I have made plenty of investment mistakes in my life. And of course, when there is an investment that goes up significantly, I much more enjoy that than when something goes down. But the first time I went to Vegas, I think I bet $1 on a chip or something, and I won, right? And it says, okay, I'll never bet anything again, so I can say I have a perfect track record. But that's not gonna carry you through life, right?
All right. Well, look, because you mentioned it earlier, and there's a ton of questions in the chat about this, let me ask you about gold. And maybe I'll ask you about gold in the miners and then let you run. You've owned gold for a long time, Axel. I remember reading your book, Sustainable Wealth, when it came out. What year was that?
2009. After the financial crisis, nobody bought any investment products. So I figured I'd take that off my bucket list. And
was it 2009? My God, that's 15 years. So anyways, you wrote a lot about the wisdom and benefits of owning gold way back then. I presume, well, I don't put words in your mouth, but is the trajectory that you're seeing us on, both as a nation and tracking the Fed here the way that you do, I assume that makes you continue to believe in the wisdom of owning gold. And you also run a precious metals miner fund. Can you just comment on the current state of the miners right now? You know, they've underperformed. They are beginning to come back to life now that gold is I think back actually at an all-time high maybe right now after today's Fed announcement. Are they running up because gold's running up? Are they running up just because everything is running up in the market run up right now? And why is gold running up? Is gold running up for all the reasons the gold bugs have been buying it, or is gold running up right now just because it's risk on and everything?
So first of all, you mentioned a book that I wrote many years ago. In that book, I describe a college savings plan in which we as my family puts aside ounces of gold every year to help save for college. And for several years, the cost of college education was going down, measured in gold. And so that's just an interesting tidbit here. The price of gold anticipates future easing in Fed policy. For a while, it was central banks. They continue to be buying. If you are not a friendly government to the US, you have a big incentive to increase your gold assets and other assets outside of the US because your treasury holdings might get confiscated someday. But to address your question on the gold miners, there's a different profile across the spectrum. We focus on the junior miners more, and maybe there the slowly coming back to life aspect can be best put into context of what's happening with the Fed, since there's a Fed talk here. Junior mining companies are exploration development companies. They're developing a mine. They have periodic need for funding. They get funding for 2 years or so, and then they need to go back to the markets to raise more money. Well, in the Federal Reserve's higher for longer environment, it was not easy for these companies to get access to funding, and they suffered. Only the best of them got funding, and the good news is the asset doesn't go away. The bad news is that when they finally raise money, shareholders might get substantially diluted. And so ever since last October, when Powell's shifted from higher for long to for longer to an easier environment, those companies have come back to life. Now, they have not gone through the roof, so to speak, and many people have been very frustrated. Well, it is in part because of that patience that Powell has, that he expressed today, because while we're on this easing path, these companies benefit, but they would benefit the most, so to speak, if we had a what people refer to as a hard landing. In a hard landing, well, in a soft landing, the traditional investor says, all right, we don't worry about it. It's all priced into the markets, and we continue holding our equities. Whereas in a hard landing, the S&P tends to suffer more, and people look more assertively for diversification. And the gold miners, especially the junior space, is a very speculative way to diversify. Speculative meaning that you only need a very small allocation to make a difference, have an impact on your portfolio. And so in a hard landing scenario, those miners tend to do well. And so now here we are kind of in this calmer environment where most things appear to be doing well. And gold does a decent job for diversification. Gold does a decent job if you're worried about the purchasing power. And there is an easing cycle. Gold miners tend to leverage on that. Just one more word before I continue ranting. the producers and the big miners, and many of them have not done all that great. They have done okay, but not great. Part of that is that they've had high production costs. They've been very much producing cash while depleting their assets. The big miners are depleting the mines that they have. They haven't been acquiring enough. And when they generate a lot of cash, they're actually less of a leverage to the price of gold. And so there will be more activity in this market, we believe. But there have been, especially the big ones have.
When you say activity, you mean merger.
M&A activity. Because when the big guys don't acquire the smaller ones, then the smaller ones will merge across themselves. And then we think that there's some exciting news coming out from several mining companies about progress they're making. One investor is currently not there. That's the speculator, the really active speculator. They love meme stocks. They love digital assets now. They used to be in the gold space. And so that dampens the volatility a tad, but don't count on that, because the moment you have a strong move, they can come back very quickly.
Well, the market loves momentum, right? So at some point, yeah. If gold and the miners really start picking up, at some point, the market's going to wake up to that and start moving capital in there. And love to get your thoughts on this, but it's not a very big market, right? So it wouldn't take much new capital flowing into that sector to really ignite prices, correct?
It's a fairly small market. The junior space where we are active is a very illiquid market. So you got to know what you're doing in that space, yes.
All right. So Axel, I told you when you asked me before we hopped on live here how long this was going to be, I said, well, probably 40 minutes to an hour, depending upon Q&A. If we run out of questions, we'll end this early. We're not going to run out of questions. Just let you know. All right. Here is one from NYU grad. Hey, buddy. Basically, his quick question here on miners is, how do you minimize country risk when looking at miners?
Well, you can't eliminate it. You can mitigate, minimize it through diversification. Right. And that's why we run a closed-end fund where we have many, many investments. We invest in management teams more so than anything else. Clearly, some countries are riskier than others. Some we stay away from. But even the U.S. is a high-risk country with political risk of permits not being made available. Right. I mean, the reason why management teams are the most important aspect is because they tend to work with all the stakeholders. And when you work with all the stakeholders, the odds of getting permits are higher. But there's no there is no assurance that things will work. And then, as we have seen in recent months, accidents can happen, and that can shut down a mine. And even when everything is done right, so it's a, and that's why gold miners are not just a levered play on gold. You do have many additional risks, including the management risk and including obviously the political risk.
Okay. Let's see here. Remor says, does Axel have a preference on short, medium, or long-term bonds, or does he just care about gold and silver? Axel, also just let everybody know here that whatever you're saying, it's not personal financial advice. You are not a financial advisor, you're a portfolio manager. So don't take anything that Axel says as anything other than just sort of educational content. And if you want to make any decisions based upon anything in this video, go talk to your professional financial advisor.
And when you listen to people that talk about these things, keep in mind of what they're doing, whether they put money at stake or not. And then just here for full disclosure, we these days invest a lot on the gold side, on the gold mining side. We used to, but not these days. We used to do a lot in currencies. It's part of the reason where my interest in central banks come from, not just the Federal Reserve. We used to trade derivatives on the yield curve. We don't do that these days, in part because of the environment that we're in and there's much demand for these products. So I have done that. That said, any opinion that I might have in this space, take it with a grain of salt, because I don't have any money at stake at this stage, right? And when I say I'm a gold person, I'm a simpleton. Like gold is just a brick. It's very simple. I tend to think that gold is the purest reflection of the monetary madness we have out there. I monitor and watch the yield curve extensively. And we have discussions. I have some quants in my firm that give me amazing analysis on this. Ultimately, though, especially when you go out the curve like the 10-year, it's subject to so many forces that trying to predict that is a bit of a fool's errand. It's very difficult. In the short term, it's much easier. In the short term, you can take a position, right? In the short term, you can say, I think it's going to be more or less than the Federal Reserve is doing. And one of the reasons we are not active in these markets these days is that if this were a quote-unquote normal economic cycle, what would happen is that the rate cuts are not sufficiently priced in. And so when the rates are high, you can bet on rates coming down, and then historically you've made a lot of money. As we have seen with this higher for longer environment and this most ever forecast recession, you're playing with fire when you do that. And also don't forget, if you're shorting bonds, this can get very expensive. You've got to have the timing right. So especially when people recommend that you short bonds, do check whether they have money at stake and whether they have been in business for a while, because it can cost you a lot of money to be right in the long run.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good point. And that's why I always, when I interview folks like you, Axel, who are capital managers on this program, I do like to call out the fact that they don't have the luxury of just having an opinion. They actually have to put their clients' capital to work based upon their conclusions.
And so I have made and lost money in this space, and I can tell you about all my winning traits, and I'm a genius, but I've been on both sides of that.
You say that, but I can't tell you how many questions we're getting about gold mining investing right now. So probably sparked like 10 more. All right. So Axel, we're going to enter into lightning round here, just because we got about 10 minutes left on the maximum side here and a ton of questions. I do want to say real quick, though, I just want to share these. This was funny. This guy, Scott Was Right, said, Adam sheds his jacket and Axel is drinking beer during the interview. This channel is going to hell quick.
Now, that's you know beer. What? If this were a beer, it would have a foam. What you know, Adam, but most of your audience doesn't know, is that I'm actually from a beer family. That my family, my ancestors, were the ones that went to the, at the time, the King of Bavaria had opened the Oktoberfest to the public. And if I had beer that didn't have any foam, they would excommunicate me. This is actually herbal tea, because I had a hellish day and I needed something simple, but I should have a beer.
All right. Well, look, everybody who can, please offer Axel a little bit of sympathy here in the live chat. He's had a hellish day, and he still made time to come on here for us. So,
and by the way, that wasn't because of you, and it wasn't even about the Fed. I can take Powell any time of the day.
Okay, my friend. Well, look, I hope your day gets better after this. Yeah. I'm trying to find one question. Kind of getting lost in the sea of questions here in the chat, but here we go. You don't have to agree with this, but the commenter Dean states the Fed has become overly politicized. What's the avenue to change this? So, what's your reaction to that statement, Axel?
Yes, it's 2008 is when the Federal Reserve decided to stop micromanaging the economy. Bernanke, in his book, sees a future where they can micromanage the economy ever more. It starts with a central bank is supposed to worry about money supply or interest rates. They should, and what that does is that it allocates credit to the economy as a whole. It becomes political when the Federal Reserve starts allocating credit to a specific sector of the economy. And that starts with buying mortgage-backed securities. The Federal Reserve has no business allocating money to the real estate sector preferentially. Mm-hmm. That is political. And the more they've gone down that road, the more they go into the political spectrum. And the problem with that is, of course, that politicians don't like that and then will draw the Federal Reserve into politics. And just one thing you said in the beginning, right? Now, the Federal Reserve likes to talk that moves markets. The more political a Fed is, the less effective Fed policy is. And so rather than uttering a few words to move the markets, they have to move rates or they have to intervene in the markets. And so it's very costly and ultimately at the expense of the middle class for the Fed to be political. So it's a very bad idea.
So I just want to interject in there because at the beginning of your answer to this, you talked about the Fed's mandate. You actually didn't mention jobs, which of course, maximum employment is part of their dual mandate. Do you see that as more of a political mandate?
Of course, it's a political mandate. And for many decades, the Federal Reserve said the best thing the Federal Reserve can do for jobs is to have unemployment low. And that is the only right answer there is. If you focus on inflation, the job market will take care of itself. Because you cannot create jobs by printing money. You can kill jobs by having Federal Reserve policy too tight, but you cannot generate jobs by doing that. And so if you focus on inflation being low and stable, that is a fertile environment for job creation. And then of course, yes, the politics at the time focused the Federal Reserve to put the jobs mandate on there. But it's a bad idea, and of course they have to follow the law, and so they used to give it at least lip service, and now it's an excuse to not act when they're supposed to be acting,
right? Or the opposite, which is to intervene where they maybe really shouldn't be. Kind of on a related note, here's a question here by Enzo, and I'm not going to ask you to answer his question the way that it's worded, but. What I do want to say is Powell was asked a question today in the Q&A about two letters that were sent to the Fed, one by Elizabeth Warren and another congressperson whose name I didn't catch, basically saying, hey, high interest rates are constraining this nation's ability to invest in green energy and to pursue our capital investments in combating climate change. Fed, you need to stop doing that. And to his credit, and I'm not taking a partisan position on those topics, but he just said, not my mandate, right? He had a more polite way of saying that, but that's basically what he said. But then he was asked about one that I guess some group of auditors sent to him that said, hey, Fed, you know, your high rates are squeezing regular people and you need to bring them down to give relief to the everyday American. And as you know, I'm 1,000% worried about the plight of the everyday American. I don't necessarily know if cutting right now is the right thing to do. But my point is he can only feel, you know, mounting political pressure the longer, kind of higher for longer goes on. How much of that is, do you think, influences the FOMC's decision making?
Well, I'll give you a few answers. A central bank can pursue sound monetary policy when the fiscal house is in order. When the fiscal house is in order, a central bank is hostage of the politicians. But to answer your question here, or the question on whether any politician is a threat to democracy or this or that, well, this is exactly the reason why the Federal Reserve should not be buying mortgage-backed securities. And that may sound very abstract, but going down that slippery slope of making ever more political decisions, during COVID, giving the direct loans to the businesses, all kinds of things that are inviting political scrutiny are just poison. And I mentioned Volcker earlier, mention him again, about kind of in the context of threat to democracy. He wrote a book in which he talked about the three verities. In order to have a sound government, you need stable prices, you need sustainable government finances, and you need strong government institutions. And if you have that frame, and by the way, politically, I don't agree with much with what Paul Volcker said. He believes in much more government defense than I do. But those principles are very good principles, because, of course, we're in a country of free speech. And we must be able to stomach, both on the left and on the right, talk that we don't agree with and that can be aggressive and whatnot. To have sound institutions, for example, you cannot have a mushrooming bureaucracy. And you need to have something much more nimble. On the fiscal side, it's kind of obvious, you need to have sustainable deficits. And then you can have the third element of sound monetary policy. The problem is that we've had deterioration in all of these, all three elements. And when that happens, then you have a threat to democracy, because then the young generation, I mean, the only thing they have seen is government intervention in 2008, which, by the way, people blame on the Fed in part. The party that's most to blame for the housing crisis is the politicians, both on the left and on the right, that pushed Fannie and Freddie into gargantuan sizes, as if you needed government subsidy for housing, and then not allowing many things happening to contain Fannie and Freddie, and that blew up, and then people react to the incentives. And so you got to get rid of that stuff if you want to save democracy in the long run.
All right, very well said. And that was actually, I think, a great concluding set of remarks to kind of begin to wind this down on. A few more things before we hop off. One is, I just got to put this up here. Matthew Sherwood said he's at the Rick Springfield REO Speedwagon concert, but he's watching this video. And I think that's amazing. I think it's an awesome concert to be at. Matt, my wife has admitted to me, she admitted early in our relationship that her high school crush was Rick Springfield. So I'm always having to compete with Jesse's girl. That sounds like a great concert. But the fact that you're taking time out to watch this while you're at that concert speaks an awful lot. So thank you. So Axel, one last question for you, and then I'm going to ask you, how can folks who want to follow you and your work, where should they go? But one of the things that I didn't really hear Powell asked much about this time around was recession risk. You know, that was the big worry for a lot of past 2 years, right? Fed's hiking rates too much. It's doing QT. The lag effects are going to build up. They're going to roll this economy over. I don't really mention the word. I didn't hear the word recession much at all this time around. But of course, the longer that we stay at 5.25, right, the more the lag effects pile up. And even if Powell brings it down to 4.6 by the end of the year, that's still high historically if we make the past 10 years history. So what do you think? Is the Fed going to succeed in managing this no landing, soft landing that Powell basically is saying, I got in the bag, folks? Or do you think there's a higher risk here that history may repeat itself, where, you know, almost every recession we've had in the past several is Fed hiked rates, plateaued for a bit, economy rolled over, and then Fed had to cut like crazy trying to catch up?
Well, that's how it usually happens, right? I mean, I was one of the ones last year suggesting we will get a recession just before the election. That can still happen. That said, again, I look at the world in terms of risks, and also I bet on the consumer. The consumer delinquency rates are going up. I do believe in the lag effects. So yes, I do think a recession is more likely. Now, of course, the Federal Reserve doesn't like to talk about recession too much, because they don't, again, for the political risk, they don't like to be blamed for getting people into recession. They said, oops, it's an unintended consequence. Sorry, we're just worrying about inflation.
CNA, they didn't really ask him this time. Like, even the journalists are giving up on it.
Yeah. And to me, a recession isn't. Of course, a recession will happen at some point, right? I mean, it's a question of time. But I do think the consumer is weakening. We do see stories about certain parts of consumer-oriented stores shutting down. And by the way, one of the reasons consumer delinquencies are up, because credit card companies reduced the credit lines at some point a few months ago, but even without that, there is more strain in the consumer. So at the same time, there are obviously plenty of people that have a lot of money. Otherwise, some of the crazy stuff wouldn't be happening in the markets, and people wouldn't be spending money on all kinds of ridiculous stuff. I have a decent income and don't spend my money on some of the things that appear to be fashionable these days. Maybe I'm just getting old.
Or maybe you are from the old school of frugality and prudence, and that's how you've built your wealth.
I have some expensive hobbies, but I am frugal in many other ways. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll leave it at that. I know one or two. all right. Well, look, I'm going to let you have the last word to opine in any way on parting bits of counsel you want to give folks. But before we get there, for folks that enjoy your perspective, Axel, and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
Well, my live interpretation on mostly economic items, but other items that affect the sort of things we talked about on Twitter at Axel Merck is the place to go. We do have a newsletter at Merck Investments. Merckinvestments.com is the place to go to sign up for that. And from there, you can also see the other things we do on the gold and gold mining side of things.
Okay. So I've got your URL up on the screen there to your website. I think I got, is it just Axel Merck, or is it Axel G Merck?
That's what I mean, just. That is, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Great. Folks, if you've enjoyed having Axel on this program, and if you like this live reaction after each FOMC meeting and Jerome Powell press conference, and would like these to continue, so if you like this format, let us know in the live chat there. And if enough folks enjoy this, we'll keep on doing this. And Axel, please take this as your invitation to come back on in April, I think, is the next one, correct?
Anytime you like to have me on, with the Fed meeting or without the Fed meeting, always love chatting with you and trying to fix the problems of the world.
Yeah, I know there's other things that we want to talk about besides
that's right. There is something. We'll keep that a secret, and we'll
put that teaser out there. But hopefully, yes, as long as it works for you, we'll keep inviting you back on to do the reactions, the live reactions to the FOMCs. Just a reminder for folks, you know, how to invest through all this stuff, how to navigate it, how to not get too bullish, how to not get too bearish, how to play these markets, but also have good risk management in place. All that stuff, you know, comes back to my consistent reminder to everybody to work with a professional financial advisor, but one that gets and takes into account all the issues that Axel and I talk about here and the guests on this channel and I talk about. I'm sure most of you viewers here already are familiar with the financial advisors that I have come on this channel week after week to show you what a good financial advisor looks like, how they think, et cetera. If you have a good one, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, feel free to talk to one of the ones that Thoughtful Money endorses to go do that. Just fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com. They're totally free. You get personalized feedback to your specific personal situation. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service that they offer. All right, Axel, well, look, as we wrap up here, is there any bit of parting comments that you'd like to make just based upon what we've talked about today to make sure that if people are leaving this video, they've got something that you think is really important for them to keep in mind?
I believe I mentioned the most important one is to invest in yourself. And also, there is a lot of uncertainty in the world, and we haven't talked about it. I mean, you mentioned about being bearish. I happen to think that the peaceful world we've had since World War II has come to an end. And so if you're inclined to sympathize with some of those things, that doesn't mean you can't have fun in life, enjoy things, and embrace the moment. But at the same time, prepare for what may be ahead in one way or another.
All right. Excellent parting words, Axel. Can't thank you enough. You're getting a lot of love here in the live comments for doing this and being willing to keep doing it. Thank you, my friend. Great to see you. I hope your day gets better. Let me know if I can help. And I hate to say it, but mine's going to get a lot better because I'm heading back.
It's just all right. Yeah, it was great talking with you.
All right, take care, my friend.